recently in her discussion of China. And in the case of Saskia, obviously we're most familiar with that in her analysis of how global, how the patterns of stratification in global cities are in fact a reflection of the position of these cities in the global political economy. Now in this book, I particularly like the version of that argument in chapter 7, where she looks at the ways in which the local activities of subordinate groups or marginalized groups may indeed be seen as having global impact. But this is an author meets critics, or at least critics converge to critique, and so therefore I should focus on critique. And I actually have only a single real critique, and that is that in this book, at least as I read it, globalization appears to be a sort of taken for granted structure imposed by some kind of authorless agency or agentless process. And I would propose that in order to look at the global, contemporary global political economy, a more fruitful approach is to see it as a structure socially constructed by agents with power in order to serve their interests. And again, following along Pun Nai's lead, since it's quite reasonable to characterize the global political economy that we currently experience as global capitalism, therefore, if we're looking for a way to think about globalization as a socially constructed product, then obviously it makes sense to start with capital. Now, for me, one of the nicest recent implementations of that perspective is, in fact, a book by the person on my left here, together with two colleagues. That is a book called Grounding Globalization, which is Eddie Webster, Rob Lambert, and Andres Bezuidenhout. Is that not too bad? Okay. In any case, they look at three refrigerator plants on three different continents. They look at it in micro, these plants and their workers and the communities that surround them in microscopic detail. And the similarities of these three different plants, one in Australia, one in Korea, and one in South Africa, are striking. In all cases, the workers are facing intensified work pressures, intensified economic anxiety, and consequently, and well, I should say intensified economic uncertainty and consequent anxiety relative to their daily lives and the daily lives of their families. And this, as Michael just pointed out, this is witnessed again in an extreme form in the suicides at Foxconn, again connecting this up to Pun's case. But what is important is that Eddie and his colleagues don't simply record that we obviously have globalization going on here, and it isn't fascinating how these different workers in different countries are experiencing the same kinds of processes and change. They make it very clear that this is not some agentless construction, but rather this is a world of work constructed to serve the interests of particular global corporations. Electrolux, Lucky Gold Star, LG, and or a world of work constructed by a corporation that has managed to remain independent, defy refrigerators, or just defy, in any case, defy in South Africa, but defy lives in a world which is shaped by the construction of these global corporations, just as firmly as the workers at Electrolux in Australia or the workers at Lucky Gold Star in Korea live in a world shaped by those corporations. Those corporations structure flows of capital, flows of goods, networks of production, etc., in a way that creates these lives. And I, Eddie could elaborate this for as long as you would like to hear about it in the question period. However, I would like to move to the other obvious agent constructing globalization, and that to do that, I would like to rely on the work of Giovanni Arrighi. Giovanni focuses on the role of hegemonic states. And he makes a simple but very profound point. And that is, states become hegemonic because of their ability to insert themselves effectively in an existing global political economy. However, having achieved hegemony, those states then reshape that global political economy in ways that reflect their specific capacities and interests. And so consequently, the global political economy is not simply the product of the interests of capital, it is also the product of the interactions of the interest of capital with the capacities and interests of the hegemonic state of the period in question. Thus, the British were instrumental in shaping the global political economy of free trade imperialism. The United States has been equally important in constructing the contemporary global political economy, both in terms of enabling the expansion of the global corporations that Eddie talks about, and in terms of promoting and diffusing the neoliberal ideological context in which both politics and economics takes place. Yeah, globalization at work.
One of his students.
Now, this role of the hegemon in shaping the global political economy brings us to one of the most interesting and controversial propositions that follows from Arrighi's perspective. Now, if the hegemon constructs a global political economy in ways that reflect its capacities and interests, and if, as seems completely reasonable, China is the impending hegemon in the century in which we are entering, then what can we say about the future global political economy that will be constructed by the interaction of global capital and a Chinese hegemon over the course of the next 50 years or 100 years, who knows? Now, I of course would love to put Pun Nai on the spot to answer this question, but I will not do that. I understand that she's not likely to want to venture into that question. But what I would point out is that this question is not a question that arises from reading Saskia's book, or at least it didn't, you know, emerge from reading the book for me. And so the perspective in Saskia's book doesn't really direct us to what I consider to be a crucial question in terms of looking at globalization and its future. And this brings us to what will be my final point. And that is, if the global political economy is constructed in response to the interests of political agents, then what about the interests of the disprivileged majority of the world? And here I would like to, first of all, extend Eddie's proposition, and that is to argue that the agency of subordinate groups should be looked at not just in terms of their ability to develop creative responses to globalization, but in terms of their ability to play a role, indeed, in the construction or reconstruction of globalization. And again, I would like to invoke Giovanni, because Giovanni's focus on hegemony never prevented him from from emphasizing the extent to which hegemonic strategies were always, at least in part, responses to the agency from below, in response to the threats created by the disruption and efforts to realize their interests of actors from below in the global economy. And I would be happy to elaborate that at great length, but I will refrain and just simply return to my earlier point with regard to Saskia's work and Chapter 7, which is to say that I think Saskia's insistence on the possibility of seeing local action from the bottom as having an impact on globalization has the possibility, the potential, for being very productively combined with a more historically grounded political economy approach of the sort developed by Giovanni Righi.
Do what I was suggesting Saskia Sassen doesn't do, and they would look at the history of those countries and the different social contexts. And once you do that, you find that the path of into a globalization or into development of Korea to the development state, through Australia to a kind of welfare state, social democracy, and South Africa to its colonial apartheid history, are two very different contexts. And I think that, to me, was what was missing from Saskia Sassen's book, and possibly, Peter, from your comment on mine.
Shanghai a lot in all her talks. I just go to them in different parts of the world. So